This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There is movement today, if not progress, on the fiscal cliff, and corporate America is reacting to Newtown. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 18th of December. And there have been some twists and turns in the fiscal cliff debate the past 24 hours or so. Talk of something that Speaker of the House John Boehner is calling Plan B. That's letting the spending cuts just happen and raising taxes only on millionaires. From the president, an offer to raise taxes only on incomes above $400,000 a year instead of $250,000. Those two will eventually get in a room and sort things out, as we all know. But while the back and forth heats up, a moment to observe what's really going on here. Washington is deciding who's rich. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff has that story.
Okay, someone's getting higher taxes out there, but where's the dividing line?
$250,000 a year in many parts of the country is not rich.
I like the number 300,000.
I think 400 is actually a really good number.
That's Douglas Besheroff of the Atlantic Council, Edward Wolf of NYU, and James Puckett of Penn State. These numbers fall on either side of the 1%. Remember that? The top 1% of earners whose incomes are about $370,000 or more. That's one reason the $400,000 number President Obama floated this week might be more palatable. It's not dragging in as many small business owners or working professionals with kids. It's a very comfortable salary, says Puckett.
They can still afford to make political contributions. They can go on nice vacations.
But he says why stop at one dividing line between the rich and not rich? Politicians could create more tax brackets for the wealthy.
There is a difference between someone who makes $400,000 and $50 million.
NYU's Wolf doesn't think higher marginal rates will have a big impact on big earners.
And most people in this income group, actually don't really care that much.
And for what it's worth, the $400,000 proposal from Obama is the same as his salary as president. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
In Newtown, Connecticut today, there were two more funerals, two more six-year-olds, amid speculation that this time the gun safety debate might actually turn out to be different. It already is in some parts of corporate America. Big retailers have pulled some gun models from their shelves, and a high-profile private equity group is going to sell the company that made the weapon used last Friday. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
After tragedies like the Newtown shooting, gun sales almost always spike, says Adam Winkler, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America.
One of the sad ironies is historically, retailers do very well when we have high-profile shootings as gun owners worry that they won't be able to buy those guns tomorrow.
And the AR-15 assault rifle used in the elementary school attack is a big moneymaker, says Winkler.
The AR-15 is perhaps the most popular firearm on the market today.
In spite of that, Dick's Sporting Goods announced it is suspending the sale of some semi-automatic rifles. Walmart and others have removed information about the AR-15 from their websites. Jen Drexler is a retail consultant with Insight Strategy Group. She says mainstream retailers have to consider consumer backlash.
Dick's Sporting Goods, like, that's the place I got my kids' soccer cleats, and my kids are six. The thought that they're selling guns at the same place that sells cleats to my six-year-olds is just unacceptable.
Investors are crying unacceptable, too. Private equity firm Cerberus said today it will sell one of its companies, Freedom Group, which makes the AR-15, after coming under pressure from its own investors. But are these just short-term reactions?
I think we're going to see a lasting effect here.
Max Wolf is a senior analyst at Greencrest Capital.
There is a bit of a feeling in the markets that this may be a pivotal moment that America gets much more serious about gun control.
One test will be how soon retailers like Dick's and Walmart resume their previous gun sales and promotions. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Shares of both those companies, Dick's and Walmart, did move slightly higher today, as did the broader market. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Raise your hand if you remember 6 or so months ago when Facebook bought Instagram. All right, good. Now, how many of you remember the purchase price? That's right, $1 billion. And finally now, who knows how Instagram makes money? Yeah, that's also right. It doesn't. The photo sharing app is free, but starting next month, you, the user, may be paying the price. Instagram is going to change its privacy policy to let it use, or to pick another word, to let it monetize your pictures however it likes. To say the change is unpopular is to understate things just a little bit. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Robert Hendricks started up his Instagram account as a fun way to share his pictures. He's a photo advisor at Michigan State's student newspaper. Now he says he's looking for alternative photo sharing sites.
The real issue I have is when people start to make money off of it. That's where it's kind of a problem for me if we don't have any say in how that's being used.
Other users complain Instagram's policy changes are so fuzzy they can't know exactly what they're agreeing to. Mark Rotenberg says that's a common problem. He heads the Electronic Privacy Information Center and says websites keep changing the rules.
We've asked the Federal Trade Commission essentially to enforce the original terms of service, not to do this kind of bait and switch with users.
Websites like Instagram argue they're still learning how to pay the bills. Declan McCullough watches the politics of the Internet for CNET.
You're using this for free. It costs Instagram a lot of money to keep its servers running and to handle customer support issues and all that. So you can understand why they want to try to make money this way.
Fair enough, says Kurt Opsahl of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Just don't trap users into things they don't want.
It's about treating the users right and being respectful of the users being a very important part of what makes user-generated content sites and social media sites what they are.
Opsahl says Instagram's new parent, Facebook, should have learned that lesson a long time ago. It already tried pushing these limits.
Ultimately, they changed a lot of their practices to go to more of an opt-in model, where if there was going to be a change in how the data was used, people would be asked first.
Opsahl predicts Instagram will end up rolling back some of its new policies to avoid losing too many users. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We are 1 week, count them, 7 short days to Christmas, and it's more likely than not that somebody on your list wants a video game, the latest installment of some blockbuster franchise. Games whose sales are equal to or sometimes beat box office receipts for big-budget movies. This year, you can add to that list of games, believe it or not, a new version of the Nintendo classic Super Mario Bros. It has sold more than 40 million copies since it first came out back in 1985. But why? What is it about that little plumber guy that makes people spend good money? To find out, I went down the street from the Frank Stanton Studios to the Game Innovations Lab at USC to talk to Sean Bouchard, Elizabeth Swenson, and Simon Wiscombe, who may just be designing the next version of Super Mario. And before we talked, we did the logical thing. We sat down on a big red sofa in front of a wall-sized television, and we played a game.
So
what do I do?
Start. The little arrow thing?
Yeah, a little arrow thing.
All right. Whoa. Zooming over a desert landscape.
The game is called Journey. You're on a quest of some sort or another, near as I can figure out, across a desert towards some mountain-looking thing. It's not a first-person shooter or a dance tutorial. There is no score. There are no weapons to discover. So what you do, well, I wasn't really sure.
Okay, hold the X, and then... Oh, I can fly! I can fly! This is good. Okay, so now, can I fly, like, directionally? Yes, I can. Oh, but now I landed again. Okay, so here's the thing. This could conceivably go on forever,
yeah.
Right? And if I don't get some kind of reward soon, I'm done, and I'm going to go, I don't know, walk the dog or something.
As you explore, you discover more of these things that make your scarf longer. And the longer your scarf is, the longer you can fly. And the flying is the reward. It's fun. It's exciting. It's something that you want to be able to do. And the game then can use that, can leverage that to tell you this is where you should go. This is how you should be behaving. Because if you behave correctly, then we'll give you more scarf.
I'm going to be really cynical here and say this game is manipulating my behavior.
Every game manipulates your behavior. Yep. That's the secret of game design. Movies express things through dialogue and through images. We express things by behavior modification, really, by telling you what sorts of behaviors will reward and what sorts of behaviors will punish.
And people pay for this.
Absolutely.
When I was first playing video games in arcades 30 years ago, it was Donkey Kong, from whence Mario came, right? Mm-hmm. What is it about that little freaking plumber guy that makes it stick around for 30 years?
I think it's a combination of the wonderful design that Nintendo is doing. They know how to make games. In Mario, the main interaction is jumping. And if that's what you want, that how you feel like that could express what your ideas are, then that's what you build a game around. And on top of that, maybe it's an unlikely hero that people love. I've never heard of a plumber being a hero in any other narrative, and maybe we're drawn to that.
This is an art form that is the nucleus and the foundation for a business that is in the many, 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 many billions of dollars. Do you guys have that in the back of your minds? I mean, are you aware that that's eventually where you're going? You're going out into this world where you're going to be in an enormous industry. Elizabeth?
I think that we're aware of it. We're, of course, deeply aware of it. But I think in the same way that film is such a huge industry, but I think a filmmaker still sees what they do as a piece of art. And I think many designers now are feeling comfortable taking on a similar role.
I definitely feel aware of the realities of the industry, but there's, you know, I think it's a balance. It's trying not to compromise our ideals too much to reach, but still reach enough to actually have an impact.
Welcome to the real world, pal.
Yeah.
All right, this mountain is far away, man.
Well, it's a journey.
What is that, a little inside gamer joke right there?
No, it's the game
design.
The game.
I know it's the name of the game. You guys, man. All right, where'd the mountain go? Am I going to get there by the time I have to leave?
No.
Coming up, Merry Christmas.
Do I really have to spend $70 on a talking meat thermometer just so I have something to give you?
No, you don't. But first, let's do the numbers. Who, you ask, is afraid of the fiscal cliff? Well, not Wall Street. The Dow Industrial's up 115 points today, 0.8%, closed at 13,350. The NASDAQ climbed 43 points, 1.4%, 3,054 at the bell. The S&P 500 jumped 16 points. That's 1.1%, 1,446 is the number. Financial firms positively giddy today. Goldman Sachs ascended 3.5% today. Bank of America pulled in more than 3.25%. Morgan Stanley stepped up 3%. Airline stocks took off as well. Delta soared more than 2.5% today. Southwest accelerated 1.33%. United lifted not quite 1% today. After being chewed up by the markets in recent weeks, Apple added close to 3% today. And talk about improving your ratings. TV ratings company Nielsen said it's going to buy the ratings radio giant Arbitron. That said, Arbitron stock up more than 23% today. Nielsen took home an extra 4%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for November. You may be using their services now if you're trying to get a package somewhere before Christmas. FedEx releases quarterly earnings. And it's become a workplace classic. The movie 9 to 5 opened on December 18, 1980. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Most days, a business is a place of business. A dry cleaner, a diner, a toy shop, it doesn't matter. I give you money, you give me stuff. But after something like last Friday, a place of business can sometimes be a lot more. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein is in Newtown.
Richard Wark felt like he had to get out of the house. He and his wife live just a few miles from Sandy Hook Elementary School. And like most of his neighbors, Wark has watched more news than is probably good for him the past few days. But even going outside, he can't get away.
There are three houses with state police cars in front of them, meaning they've lost three children in our neighborhood.
So he and his wife drove to my place, one of those restaurants with familiar faces.
We're here for therapeutic reasons, to get away from, hopefully to escape a little bit, go out to eat, have some other people around us, hopefully feel a little bit better because it's been very difficult.
The restaurant looks a lot like the bar in Cheers, a neighborhood place. And late in the evening, it was still full with locals eating pizza, drinking beer, and trying to recapture a little of what's been lost in the past few days. All over, people are seeking each other out in shops, in libraries, in the Newtown hardware store.
A lot of times, just talking about a horrific event such as this just makes people feel better in general. It just makes them feel a little sense of relief that they can come and speak to somebody.
Daniel Sorrentino owns the shop. In the weeks and months to come, his family will make donations and gifts to the town. But for now, one small thing he can do is be there for the people who walk in, because his customers need more than hammers, nails, and paint.
As you can see on everybody's, everybody who walks in the door, you can see it on their face. You could just, read it in their body language that everybody is, is really, really upset.
Overnight, businesses in town have become places to grieve and cope together. Mary Kay Novak owns Your Healthy Pet, a pet food and supply store. Her counters are filled with dog biscuits that look like Christmas cookies. She knows these people and their cats and dogs. They're like family. It's been hard.
We break down every time we talk to people. You can take so much and you talk, and then it just hits home and makes us really physically sick and ill. It gets really hard to talk about after a while.
Lots of business owners in town say they feel a profound desire to do something. A number of companies have pledged money. Others plan to make donations. Peter D'Amico offers basketballs, tennis, weights, and a place to run around. D'Amico manages the NYA Sports and Fitness Center in town. Today, the place is crowded with kids from Sandy Hook Elementary School and their families. D'Amico says he feels lucky to see the kids run, sweat, and laugh.
Yeah, that's the best thing we can do for the community, have those kids focus on something else. And to see their smiles on their face is it's wonderful.
Like most people in town, D'Amico doesn't have answers, just a need to be involved, trying to help. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A story now from our Wealth and Poverty Desk.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
On Tuesday last week, Michigan became the 24th state in the country to adopt what are called right-to-work laws. They let workers covered by union benefits not have to pay union dues or fees. Michigan, maybe more than any other state, has been a stronghold of organized labor in this country. 50 years ago, half of Michiganders belonged to a union. Today, just 20% or so do. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark was in Flint, Michigan, not too long ago to trace organized labor's rise and slow-motion fall.
Sometimes to look forward, you've got to look back. So I went to the birthplace of the modern American labor movement. There's an actual place you can pinpoint. It's near downtown Flint, just off United Auto Workers Highway, which has more than a few cracks in it these days.
Solidarity for
forever, solidarity forever.
My tour guide is Geraldine Blankenship, age 92, white hair in a bun, red lipstick. Long ago, she helped get unions started right here on a picket line.
Where would you picket?
In the north end, where there's no longer a building.
Geraldine's looking out the window of her Buick at what is now a giant, half-empty office park. But for most of the 20th century, it was a giant factory for GM. Geraldine's father hired in here in the early 30s, earned less than a dollar a day. And this is the kind of sentence that barely sounds real anymore. But the family was so poor, she had to walk to school barefoot in the snow.
I didn't have a pair of shoes that were decent at all. They were held together with some tape that my father had gotten at the shop.
Her dad worked 10-hour shifts with no breaks and saw men collapse from exhaustion on the assembly line. Then, one night in December of 1936, he called the house.
He said, "I got tired of being a slave. We're on strike. It's going to be a sit-down. I'll be home when it's over."
A few weeks in, Geraldine's dad called again. He sounded like he wanted to come home. Her mom had an answer for him.
She said, "If you come out, I will divorce you." She believed in strikes.
After 44 days, the strike worked. GM, the largest car company in America, signed a contract with this new union called the United Auto Workers. And eventually, the rest of the industry did, too.
Teamwork! Teamwork!
Geraldine's dad got better working conditions and better pay, and
I got a pair of ice skates for Christmas.
And in a way, those ice skates launched Geraldine and her kids and their kids on a path out of poverty.
GM Mansion, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Even if it wasn't obvious right away.
They called us shop rats.
That's Geraldine's son, Tom Blankenship. He started at GM as soon as he graduated high school in the 1960s.
Pretty much everybody understood that if you weren't college material, and a lot of us weren't.
You thought you weren't. At we didn't time, have the money.
Yeah, there wasn't any money for that sort of thing. And the plants were easy to hire into.
And you could make a decent living, even without a college degree, thanks to a union contract that included overtime pay, health care.
That was one of the benefits of the union. We worked our way into a middle class because of that.
By the time Tom was middle-aged, he and his wife owned a house.
Little two-bedroom house.
Two cars.
A cabin up north.
And they could afford to send their kids to college.
The nation's secret was teamwork.
But by now, we know what happened next. By the 1990s, the global economy and the way Tom and his union fit into it had changed. He and his mom have driven me across town to Tom's old plant to show me what was left behind.
Right on the corner over here is where I worked for 28 years.
Describe it for somebody who can't see it.
It's a square mile of nothing now. I didn't even realize that they were tearing it down until I drove by there on Dort Highway one day, and I realized some of the places were gone.
As the plants left to Mexico and China, or downsized because of automation, a lot of Flint crumbled. As we drive through town now, we pass miles of run-down or burnt-out buildings.
Lots of arson.
Tom points to one empty building that used to be a union hall.
If the plant's gone, there's not much use in a union hall.
What do you want to be when you grow up again?
Dad.
And what does your dad do?
He likes to go to work every day.
And what does he do at work?
Loads a robot.
Corbin Cox is the great-grandson of another of Flint's original sit-down strikers. But Corbin lives about an hour south of Flint because that's the only place his parents could find work. Keith Cox, Corbin's dad, is 42 and works as a supervisor in a car parts factory that's expanded in the last few years. He says he appreciates what unions have done for his family.
Probably got me to where I am now, but I've never been a part of one, so I don't know.
Early on, Keith tried to get a job at the union shop where his dad worked, but it was about to close. He worked at a non-union plant for years until they laid the most senior workers off to save money, he says. Now, he's just happy to have a job. And at least in his own life, Keith says unions seem kind of irrelevant.
I don't think a union's ever hurt anybody, but I just don't think they're necessary anymore.
Still, when I ask him how he feels about his grandfather and the other strikers, he gets emotional. I ask him why.
Don't really know. Probably because I'm proud of him.
Keith wants his son to be a lawyer. In Flint, Michigan, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the program, what's next for the middle class in Michigan? Before that, though, it's worth taking a minute to see what Flint looks like today. We've got a slideshow on our website, marketplace.org. The National Retail Federation says we collectively are going to spend more than $500 billion this holiday season, almost $600 billion to be just a bit more precise. But even a number that big doesn't tell the whole story. Commentator Beth Tytel points out that it doesn't break out the amount spent on gifts that present a challenge so frustrating or that become such a time suck that the gift giver starts to develop irritation or full-blown hostility toward the giftee.
They aren't immortalized in rhyme like the Grinch. Their names aren't synonymous with misanthropy, like Scrooge. But every holiday season, untold numbers of these spirit-sapping characters appear in our midst. They are the hard to buy for, and like the devil himself, they assume many forms. The brother-in-law with no hobbies or interests, the enthusiast so serious about her leisure time pursuits that a civilian will always miss the target, the dad who overnights himself whatever he wants, the teenager with unknowable preferences, the mom who insists she needs nothing. Oh, don't even think about me. The baby with fussy parents. The stress of satisfying the hard to buy for is probably worse than ever this year, thanks to a combination of factors. The still lousy economy, of course, and the growing recognition that all this stuff we buy not only harms the earth, but doesn't even leave us happier. Do I really have to spend $70 on a talking meat thermometer just so I have something to give you? Not to make excuses for the overly particular, but maybe they're right. Many people are already drowning in stuff. By late 2008, the average American was consuming three times as much as the average person did in 1960, according to a Boston College sociology professor. And social scientists affiliated with UCLA found that three-quarters of our nation's garages are too crammed with clutter to hold cars. No wonder the season's most wanted present is the gift card. But even one of those won't necessarily solve your gifting problems. There are now so many gift cards to bowling alleys and steakhouses and beauty supply shops that choosing the right one has become its own challenge and spawned its own depressing trend, the online gift card exchange, where the hard-to-buy-for can sell the gift cards they don't want. Maybe it really is better to give than to receive.
Beth Tytel writes for the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is, I guess, a sign of the times, although that doesn't make it any less depressing. There's a company in Salt Lake City, Utah, called Amendment 2. It makes lightweight body armor, mostly for police and military, which you'd expect. Since Friday, though, sales of armored kids' backpacks have tripled, the CEO says. They've got a teen model, and then one with the Avengers on it, and one with Disney princesses as well. In not unrelated news today, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder vetoed a bill that would have allowed concealed weapons in churches and schools and daycare centers in that state. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.